This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. Woohoo! And it's an interview again. So I've got someone on the show here who wants to talk about how great his book is. His name is Daniel. And Daniel, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Hi, my name is Daniel Price, and my book came out February 4th. It's called The Flight of the Silvers, published by Penguin and Blue Rider Press. And it is a 608-page chunkster about superpowered people on an alternate Earth, but much more than that.
There's nothing wrong with 608 pages.
You know, thank you. I'm so glad to hear that because some people don't agree.
They think it's too long or too short.
You know, some people wanted more. Some people wished that I had included a little more, like a couple hundred more pages of world detail. Mm-hmm. And others were more accustomed to beach reads. So they were kind of daunted by the sheer amount of detail in it.
Really? Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Can't please everyone.
No, you can't. And if you try, you'll just fail.
Pretty much.
It's kind of sad that way. So let me ask you this, Daniel. Is this your debut novel?
No, this is my second novel, but this is my first sci-fi book. So for all intents and purposes, I guess it is a debut. My first novel was a slice of life comedy about publicists in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So this is a real departure for me.
Okay. That is. Yeah. What made you decide to get into SF?
You know, it's funny. I've had the idea for Flight of the Silvers in my head now for about 15 years, even before I wrote my first novel.
Wow.
And it was, I knew from the beginning that it was just a giant, giant idea. And it was intimidating at first because I've grown up with sci-fi pretty much since the moment I could read. And I just knew the pain of bad science fiction. I did not want to contribute to that.
So that brings up two things. Before we go too far, so what's the elevator pitch on The Flight of the Silvers? What's the hook? What are you going to tell our listeners so that they go right now and click buy?
Flight of the Silvers basically is about two sisters and four strangers who survive the end of our world only to find themselves on an advanced parallel Earth. This is a place where restaurants move through the air like flying saucers, where the fabric of time can be bent by even kitchen appliances. It's a completely familiar yet utterly different world that they're in. And these six people are chosen for reasons that they don't even know. They're given a silver band on their wrist, which is why they're called the Silvers, by these very beautiful but scary people. And once they arrive on this new world, the bracelets take them there. They are pretty much embroiled in a life or death struggle, and they're trying to figure out why they were picked, what they can do to survive, because they have all sorts of enemies chasing after them.
Okay, very cool.
Oh, and has superpowers.
Yes, and the sky literally falls on them.
The sky literally comes down in a crushing sheet of whiteness.
Okay, so all very cool. So now, you know, we'll give everybody a second because they're going and they're buying it right now. So you know, that's kind of cool. You said you grew up with science fiction and you know bad sci-fi, and obviously you know good sci-fi. You know, it's all subjective. But what influenced you? I mean, what did you grow up with? What made you decide, you know, to embrace the inner geek and kind of write some sci-fi?
It's funny. I was split two ways in terms of my influences. On the more bombastic side of the spectrum, I've been a X-Men reader for as long as I can remember. I do not remember my life before X-Men. And I just devour those comic books. Okay. I think my collection goes back to issue 180-something.
Okay.
So, and more than any other superhero comic, I just love the dynamic of the family, the fact that they weren't just costume-wearing heroes, that they were also kind of put upon. That they were hated and feared, but they were still doing good deeds, and it just blew me away. So I love the fact that almost all of their powers had some kind of drawback, had some kind of complication. So it wasn't just a matter of these people going pow, bang, boom, that there was thought put into their abilities. And I've always wanted to write a story that incorporated that.
Okay.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, I've been a huge fan of Kurt Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. He is, to me, and he never really liked to consider himself a sci-fi writer. But if you ever read Slaughterhouse-Five or The Sirens of Titan, you knew his ideas are so far out there that I mean, they are just 12 miles deep into the realm of sci-fi and beyond. And Slaughterhouse-Five in particular kind of blew my mind. The things he did were just with the perception of time. Like, he wasn't necessarily – the story wasn't about time travel itself, but our just the way our personal relationship with it, the way we perceive it. And that has always fascinated me. I think I read it when I was like 12 or 13, and it just blew me away. So I think I wanted to go further with that. And Flight of the Silvers has packed from front to back with time-bending shenanigans without time travel, without the usual tropes of paradox, anything else. I wanted to go into time manipulation, and I do that in at least a dozen different ways in the book.
Okay.
So basically, the main characters also, at some point, they all get different time-bending abilities. There is a woman who can slow down the clock and basically move faster than everyone else, mm-hmm. but her added momentum makes her kind of brittle. So if she even something like pounds a door, she is in danger of breaking all her fingers.
Oh, wow.
There is a boy who can conjure up image ghosts of the past, whether it's a full hologram of him from a minute ago, or if he just paints the air with last night's darkness, he can just call up images as sound and light. So, you know, I just – interesting things like that that I personally – other people may have seen it before. I personally have not seen it before. And I wanted to write the pros and cons and just kind of explore what it would be like to have those abilities.
Gotcha.
Now, go back to the Vonnegut thing for 1 second. The reason why he inspired me, not just with his crazy ideas, but he really influenced me, the fact that he put character first. He didn't just throw these ideas at you. He always built them around a very human story. And for all of the crazy ideas in Flight of the Silvers, this is still a character story. This is still all about the people. And that is one thing I definitely can attribute to both X-Men and Kurt Vonnegut, as different as they seem, but they both influenced me heavily.
Favorite X-Men comic book writer? Go.
Oh, it has to, Chris Claremont. Chris I didn't Claremont. Have to think about it.
Okay. So you like the Claremont run?
I love the Claremont run. I think the X-Men felt the most like a family during the 17 years that he was writing it. I mean, he really nailed them. Now, it helped that when he was writing it, there were only one, maybe two X-Men comics at the time. Now there are like a zillion.
Oh, yeah.
So they don't feel like as much of a family anymore. They feel completely fractured. But when he wrote them, they were just one big group. I wouldn't call them a happy group, but they were a group.
So the Claremont burn kind of together?
Claremont burn, I mean, even after Byrne left sometime around shortly after the Dark Phoenix saga, but I think Claremont's whole run, pretty much. I mean, Claremont kept going for a good several years after Byrne left, and pretty much anything from that main run was just excellent.
Okay. Do you consider Power Pack to be part of the X-Men family of characters and books?
Oh, yeah. Well, they certainly had some stuff to do with them. They crossed over on occasion, but I never actually read the Power Pack comic.
Correct answer is no.
Okay. I was trying to be polite. I didn't want to insult anyone who happened to love Power Pack. But
no, everybody knows that my biggest complaint when you talk about the crossovers is when they crossed over the Fall of the Mutants and you had to buy an issue of Power Pack.
I do have that. That's the one issue I bought, yes.
Yes, it's the one issue I bought too, and it still pisses me off to this day.
You know what? I'll agree with you on that.
So now, are you still reading comics?
On occasion, you know, I haven't done the X-Men comics in a while. It's just become so fragmented, so different. Everything is a crossover now. I mean, yes. You thought that Power Pack thing was annoying. They've gone into overdrive. And mm-hmm. I can understand why they do it. I mean, comics are kind of hurting right now as an industry, and they really need to gets you with reboots and crossovers and everything else, but it just got to be too much for me, and I think they kind of lost sight of the continuity. Well, at least I know I did.
Oh yeah, well that can be difficult. They just posted something about, you know, people are really annoyed with the constant renumbering.
Yes,
and they're not going to stop doing it, because every time they renumber a book, they go back to number one. They see a huge surge in sales.
You think at some point that would just stop working?
You would. You would, but apparently it's not. And so they're not going to stop it anytime soon. They're not going to stop until the surges stop. But anyway, so the X-Men kind of influenced you. The Kurt Vonnegut stuff did. Was there anything else? I mean, anything that you just sat there and it just blew your mind and you said, gosh, this is what I need to do. I need to write these kinds of stories.
Yeah. I have to say Watchmen.
Okay. Watchmen.
I read those. The only DC comics that I read issue to issue back in 1986, and I still remember the frickin' 3-month gap between issues 11 and 12. I think I still get like flashbacks to that horrible time.
Sure.
But that one really affected me in terms of showing a parallel Earth that is both really familiar and really different. Like it just showed, it really kind of showed what you can do with alternate history.
Okay.
Starters. And I love the way the characters all weaved around each other in that one. It was so beautifully plotted, so beautifully drawn, every single thing about it. I mean, it's almost cliche at this point to rave about Watchmen, but at the risk of sounding hipster, I was raving about it before it was cool.
So was I, but that's okay. Hey, do you ever get into any of, I'm tongue tied. Do you ever get into any of the other Alan Moore stuff?
You know, I do. Is his work on Top 10. He did work for America's Best Comics that I absolutely loved. And the best one of that was Top 10. I don't know if you read it. Mm-mm. But it takes place on this world where pretty much almost everybody has superpowers. And it is an absolutely insane place. And it's about it centers on a police precinct in this world. All with superpowered, heavily, of course it's Alan Moore, heavily damaged individuals.
Sure.
But it only ran for about, is it 12, maybe more issues, but two trades. I only read those in trades, but they were really inventive, really clever.
Now, you talk about how you wanted to write the stories about the character, so it's very character driven. So did you pull any of that from Alan Moore? Like, are your characters damaged, or are they pretty straightforward? Are people going to identify with them?
These are – I'm glad you asked that because that's been another bone of contention with a small portion of my readership is these are flawed characters. They are not so damaged to the point where they're killing innocent people. But at the time that the book starts, they're pretty much all in a weak place, especially after their world ends. They're not going to be at their best. So they don't necessarily all get along with each other at first. They're not entirely thinking clearly at first or making the best decisions. And it was really important to me, especially in a story with flying cars and force fields, to have characters who act as realistically as possible to these unrealistic circumstances. And so for the first several chapters, they really are just freaking out. Like, what's happening here? And they're just not – they're not heroic at first.
Sure. Well, and that's one of my bones of contention with comic books is, you have the young teenager suddenly imbued with all these powers, and they immediately go to with great responsibility line, great power, great responsibility, and they're going to be these responsible. No, they're going to be stupid. They're going to do stupid stuff. You know,
What I love about Spider-Man's origin is that he didn't immediately go into superheroes.
No, he went and, he decided to make money.
Right. As anyone would.
Because he wanted to be the big shot, and he wanted to have money. So he went off and did the stupid stuff. And it took that to kind of spur him forward. But that's not the same with all comic book characters. I mean, most superheroes, they immediately go, oh my gosh, I have to do good and I have to help people.
Right. And it's the same complaint I have with novels, too. There are a lot of, to use the term, Mary Sues and Gary Stews, just the ones who are so unrelentingly perfect from the beginning. They start out strong. And for me, the characters are boring to read. They're even more boring to write. I will never write people like that because where do they go? If they start out perfect, then how do they grow as characters?
Exactly.
And part of the fun for me for Ready Flight of the Silvers was having these characters develop over the course of the story, and that every time they take two steps forward, they'll take a step back and relapse into their old ways as people do. But then by the end of the book, they really are a cohesive unit. They've gotten used to their abilities and they know how to And of course, they'll be risking their lives for each other. That they become really like a tight family at this point. So, but you, by the time you get there, you feel their progression because you remember how they were at the beginning of the book.
Very good. So they have character arcs.
They most definitely do. Each and every one of them has a separate arc.
Very good.
But some people, you know, I'm looking at the Amazon reviews, every 5
You're not
minutes.
Supposed to do that. No, oh, Daniel. No. See, you're not supposed to look at the reviews, dude.
If they can find a way to put Amazon in a crack pipe, I would smoke it. Amazon and Goodreads, I mean, yeah, there are – I just can't stop. But it's fascinating to me. I mean, there are some really – there's some very articulate people out there, and some of them make some really good points. And it's been fascinating to me to see how different people react, because the ones who praise the book say the characters are the strongest part of the story, and the ones who pan the book say the characters are the weakest part of the story. But I find it interesting to see that split.
Yes.
Just to see how different people will process these characters.
I've told the story before. I was in high school. It was like sophomore year in high school. We had a substitute teacher. The assignment was to write a story where you are the main character and you have a secret identity.
Oh, wow.
And so then you weren't allowed to sign it. You had to turn it in anonymously. And so I wrote this thing and I turned it in. And the next day, the substitute teacher goes up and he's reading all of the best ones. And he's going through them. And he says, and then this is my absolute favorite. And he reads mine. And so I am just on cloud nine. And then the next day, the regular teacher comes back and he's going through the assignments. And I remember him because he had this huge mustache and he always wore these gigantic belt buckles. And he comes in and he says, okay, everybody settle down. He's like, let's go over yesterday's assignments. And he's going through them and he's like, all right, I want to read to you the worst possible one. And he picked mine out and said it was the absolute worst. So, you know, two people, two completely different opinions. It's always going to be that way. That's why I say, you know, you gotta learn to temper yourself on that.
Well, I was about to say you have a really cool teacher until you got to that last part. That's just mean.
Well, hey, you know what? Two different teachers, two different opinions. And that's the point.
It's a fun assignment though.
Yeah. And I don't know. I talked to a lot of different authors, and what I'm curious now is you're reading so many of these reviews. This is part of a series that you have planned.
Yep.
And you have an idea of where you want this to go. You know what you're going to do in book two. You know what you're going to do in book three. Are you now letting these reviews influence that? Are you changing stuff based on that?
They're not affecting the plot. That is, I won't say set in stone, but I feel very confident about where I'm going, and somebody complaining about, you know, the bitchy characters isn't going to change that. But there are some things that I'm about 60% into book two now, and I can see myself altering small details, like the two sister characters who are at the center of the cast. There was going to be a part where they argued about something in book two. And after seeing a whole bunch of complaints about how they bickered way too much, I was like, okay, I think they can get through this scene without fighting.
But siblings do that.
Siblings definitely do that. But they went through such hell in book one, and they come to such an understanding by the end of it. I was like, you know what? Maybe I won't screw with that. And I found a more interesting way to see them, a different way for them to handle a conflict with each other. In the second book, they have a difference of opinion over a life or death matter. So it's not trifling at all. But I just wanted to see if there's some different way they can go about it. And that was definitely influenced by some of the negative reviews.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, and there's some word choices I definitely will never use again. Three different reader reviews called out. He's like, you have a really weird use of the word leer. It's like, what? It's something my copy editor, Penguin, never caught. I never knew it until I started seeing the reviews. When Kirkus, they gave me a starred review, which was lovely. And the one negative was I had a weird way of using the word leer. I was like, what? It baffled the hell out of me. But you can be damn sure I'm not coming within a mile of that word in book two. That doesn't affect the overall plot. So they can get to the ending I have in mind without leering at anything.
That's fun. So, okay, now there is I almost want to say it's a trend. There have been more superhero novels coming out than I've seen in the past. You know, basically where it's not necessarily your comic book superheroes, but there's definitely been a lot of novelizations of that use the superhero trope. have you read any of those? Were any of those influences? Any of those make you like spark your imagination and say, hey, maybe I can do this too. You know, I've always wanted to do this, but I didn't think anybody'd read it. And now I see that other people are doing it. So maybe there is a market for it.
Well, here's a confession. And if I have second thoughts about this, we'll delete the audio. But I do not read as much as I should. I definitely don't read as many contemporary books as I should, especially when I'm writing. It screws me up.
Oh, okay.
Either I will unconsciously it influences me in the wrong ways.
No, I understand. Because, for example, Shauna McGuire confessed that she won't watch certain TV shows because they're too close to the things that she's writing and she doesn't want to be unduly influenced by them.
Yeah. And based on the books of hers I read, I probably wouldn't want to read hers as I'm writing. I think we have some similar styles.
Well, for example, she the Lost Girl on the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi. She doesn't watch that because it's too close.
Oh, because of all the Fae.
Because of all the Fae, yep.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. That's probably a big reason that why I wouldn't, but it didn't stop me from reading all of Game of Thrones, which has nothing to do with the stuff I was writing, and I just devoured those like potato chips.
Okay. So you're all caught up on that?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, five or six more years and you'll get another book.
I know he's not a spring chicken, so I my fingers are crossed. But if he does pass on before the series is done, I'm going to go Orpheus on him. I'll just meet him in the afterlife, the MacBook under my arm. I'll slap it down in front of him and say, finish.
You don't think they'll approach Sanderson?
He's busy enough with his own 10-book epic. I don't know how he does it. He writes fatter books than mine quicker.
Yeah, I just actually got his latest one, and right now I'm using it to prop my car up. I'm just kidding. No, definitely he can write, and he can write a lot, and he has a lot to say, which is awesome.
I do want to read those also. I've heard nothing but good things about them, and I read the Mistborn trilogy and really liked it. The guy definitely, he knows what he's doing.
And the nicest guy in the world, if you ever get a chance to meet him.
Oh, that's great. And he also has, with Mistborn at least, he did a great twist on superpowers. He made them all metal-based. Mm. I mean, technically it's a magic system, but he made it really – I found it really interesting. He did a great job with that.
Very cool. So then what do you read for pleasure? I mean, when you sit down and you're like, oh, I just want to read something right now, what do you pick up?
I'm buying certain graphic novels and trades like Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. I've been enjoying that before the TV show, and now the TV show is so different from the comic book. I can enjoy both without any spoilers. What else do I, you know, I feel like Sarah Palin right now. It's like all of them. I don't know. I'm really not sure how, you know, I pick up things here and there.
Okay.
I read books small and large. I just read the Thinking Woman's Guide to Real Magic by Emily Croy Barker, which was actually surprisingly had a lot of similarities to Flight of the Silvers. I mean, it starts with a flawed woman who finds herself on this sort of parallel world, but not really parallel, more magical world. But it was a really detailed, fleshed out, not just the characters, but the world itself. And it was really well done.
Very cool.
So I think that was the most recent book I really devoured.
Okay. And are you doing a book tour? Are you going to be anywhere where people can come see you? Any bookstores, any conventions coming up?
I got my professional pass at Comic-Con, my first professional badge. I mean, I was so proud.
Okay. This is San Diego Comic-Con?
San Diego Comic-Con in July, yes.
Okay.
So I am definitely going to that one. But in the meantime, it's my biggest priority right now is plotting ahead on book two because it's another big fat book.
Okay.
And I want the wait between books to be as quick as possible.
Gotcha. So no plans for like a Worldcon or anything like that?
Not at the moment, no. But I'm keeping my options open.
Okay. So if someone wants a signed copy of the book?
That's interesting. Well, I know that VJJ Books has a whole bunch of pre-signed books from yours truly. If they want one signed directly, I suppose that they can contact me through my website.
Okay.
At danielprice.info. And it's easy to contact me through that and maybe something can be worked out. But I don't have any kind of formal system in place yet.
Okay.
Perhaps I should.
You never know. What about social media? Can they find you on Twitter and Facebook?
Yes. My handle on both is Silvers Guy. It's Silvers with an S, plural. GUI.
Very cool. And anything else you want to tell our listeners before I let you go?
I hope you give the book a chance, people out there, and I hope you enjoy it. And if not, then I hope you find something that is equally enjoyable.
All right. Well, Daniel, it sounds like an awesome book, an awesome premise. I wish you all the luck in the world, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Patrick. This has been great.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.